Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm going to be talking mainly about the Communist Party of Great Britain during the 1930s, but also the relationship between the Communist Party and the Spanish Civil War, and how the decisions of Stalin regarding the German Communist Party affected what happened in Great Britain. So, to start at the start, the most significant strategic blunder Stalin makes, or of the many that he does make during the 1930s, was probably to order the Communist Party of Germany not to cooperate with the Social Democrats. I'm going to read tonight from The Enemy Within, The Rise and Fall of the British Communist Party, by Francis Beckett. And Francis Beckett writes, "Moscow theorists were sure that Germany would be the next country to turn to communism. The German Communist Party, the biggest in the world outside Russia, won nearly 6 million votes in the November 1932 election. The Social Democrats won 7.2 million and the Nazis 11.7 million. So there were 13 million votes for the left, enough to beat the Nazis. But the new line, class against class, prevented the communists from allying with the Social Democrats against Hitler's National Socialist Party. This stunning Comintern miscalculation was one of the reasons why Adolf Hitler became Chancellor on the 30th of January 1933. Now, to provide an explanation here as to why Stalin took the decision that he did, you have to look into the kind of the dark recesses of Marxist-Leninist thinking. For the Bolsheviks, in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution, and for the Stalinists who sort of followed them, the most dangerous kind of political entity really was the Social Democratic Parties. Why? Because the Social Democratic Parties, in the view of the Bolsheviks and the Stalinists, were there to prevent revolution from breaking out. They were, in fact, the most useful weapons that the capitalist system had. Most social democrat parties, the Labour Party in the UK, the Social Democrats in Germany, and their equivalents across the rest of the continent, didn't want revolution. They wanted gradual progressive change. They were no friends of the capitalist system, but thought it could be harnessed and tamed to improve the living conditions of the working classes, and that the raw energies of capitalism could be used for a kind of a common good. The Bolsheviks, Lenin and later Stalin, both believed that this kind of compromise with the capitalist system was nothing more than an attempt to dull the forces of revolution, to make life pleasant enough for the working classes so that they would accept their position permanently. And there is something to be said for this. It's probably not exactly how social democrats around the world see themselves as capitalist patsies, but there is something to abundant evidence on the centre-left parties around the world that they have a kind of a fairly happy compromise with the capitalist system and have no interest in overthrowing it. One only needs to look at even the mildest challenges to the established capitalist order in recent years in the Labour Party or in Bernie Sanders' campaign for the Democratic nomination to see how vehemently moderate challenges by the left are seen off. Stalin's great error was not to overlook this, that it would have been far better for Stalin had he allowed a popular front government of far-left and centre-left to emerge in Germany to keep the Nazis out. There's every evidence to suggest that after 1932, perhaps had Hitler not seized power then perhaps the Nazi moment may well have passed. It's kind of tempting to sort of counterfactual that one. So Stalin created a terrible problem for himself by ordering Comintern and therefore the Communist Party of Germany not to cooperate with the Social Democratic Parties. In September, the trial of four communists who were accused of burning down the German parliament, the Reichstag, began. And one of them was actually a Comintern agent, the founder of the Bulgarian Communist Party, Georgi Dimitriev, who defended himself. He was so effective in his oratory, so eloquent was he, that he made a very clear case that the Nazis, as is more than likely, actually burned down the Reichstag themselves. The four of them were freed. This is, again, quite an extraordinary fact that the four accused of burning down the Reichstag were able to beat the accusation and walk free. And that shows that at this point, obviously the Nazis' control of the legal and judicial system in Germany was nowhere near as established as it was later on. When Dimitriev was acquitted, he returned to Moscow. In Moscow, he tried to convince Stalin that the Comintern policy of class against class, of decrying the Social Democrats as social fascists, was a mistake. Francis Beckett writes, "The Comintern Seventh World Congress was delayed while the battle raged, for no one in Moscow wanted a debate until they had decided on the outcome. The Congress met eventually in August 1935. As usual, no one admitted that the Comintern had made a mistake. Dimitriev's report, The Working Class Against Fascism, was presented as a response to the new situation." So this was a great little Stalinist ploy of preventing criticism, saying, well, whatever you have to say on the subject now, the situations, the material conditions that we are presented with are different. Therefore, the decision in the past wasn't a wrong one, but it was based on different material circumstances. But it stood the policy on its head and called for a united front of all left-wing parties against fascism. Dimitriev's credentials in the battle against fascism were now assured. He led the Comintern after this, and his prestige was crucial in keeping the Communist Party in line in later years. In 1945, he returned to his native Bulgaria as the head of the government. So, what does this tell us? Well, there was an immense amount of consternation and worry and concern when Hitler came to power. The Dmitrov Report, The Working Class Against Fascism, gave Stalin his opportunity to say, circumstances have changed, therefore we can change. United fronts, popular fronts, are the way to go. However, across Europe, there were new popular front organisations emerging anyway. There were, of course, communists and social democrats who thought, whatever our ideological disagreements, the fascists are the great threat. So in France, an alliance between the communist and the socialist parties, called the Popular Front, had begun in 1932. Harry Pollitt, the leader of the British Communist Party, had dumped many of the ideas of class against class during 1933. And a few days after Hitler came to power, the Independent Labour Party, the much more left-wing iteration of the Labour Party, and the Communist Party held a joint demonstration against fascism. Harry Pollitt, under leadership of the party, began to meet more regularly with the members of the ILP, including Fenner Brockway. It was a hard thing for members of the Independent Labour Party to accept, having been criticised so heavily and undermined often by the Communist Party of Great Britain previously, because now an accommodationism was being gradually introduced into the conversation. In 1932, the situation in Britain changed with the founding by Sir Oswald Mosley of the British Union of Fascists. Mosley, a significant figure who had started out life in the Labour Party and had left the Labour Party in 1930 in a rage when he had not been, his economic memorandum, the Mosley memorandum, had been ignored. He was, had always been a rising star in the Labour Party. He'd been a favourite of Ramsay MacDonald and had been tipped to be Foreign Secretary, but was overlooked, and he felt particularly aggrieved, being as he had been tasked with the job of trying to do something about unemployment. He had created a kind of a corporatist Keynesian, sort of quasi-Keynesian approach to alleviating the problem. So he formed a new party, and then in 1932 formed the British Union of Fascists, this organisation of disparate fascist groups across Great Britain. He was a talented orator. He looked to both Mussolini and Hitler as inspiration, and of course he gained the approval of the Daily Mail, who published, Lord Rothermere, the owner of the Daily Mail, published a headline, "Hurrah for the Black Shirts." Mosley, most importantly, had money, and he had inherited a huge fortune. And he also mingled in moneyed circles, the kind of aristocratic wealth that looked approvingly on fascism and saw it as being the thing that would protect the wealthy from the threat of communism. The fact that Mosley left the Labour Party, writes Francis Beckett, because it was too conservative, made him more dangerous. Mussolini had come from the left. France's future fascist leader, Doriot, was in 1932 one of the leaders of the Parti Communiste Français. With the left fractured and despairing after the traumas of 1931, the division in the Labour Party and the establishment of a national government, unemployment, poverty, injustice still rampant after a post-war decade of unfulfilled promises by Labour, Mosley could attract support that in better times would go to the
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Left. His supporters included former IRP members. His chief ideologue was a former communist, Raven Thompson. Working class recruits included two unemployed communists who had just finished prison terms for distributing communist leaflets to soldiers. The Communist Party pioneered the policy of disrupting his meetings. At a vast meeting at Olympia in June 1934, Mosley was prepared for a disruption. He stood under a spotlight surrounded by 24 amplifiers. Whenever he was interrupted, Mosley would pause, and the spotlight would swing on the hecklers and uniformed black shirts would throw them out. The violence alienated establishment figures and helped ensure Mosley's decline. So the conditions for fascism in Britain were different. They were not quite as propitious as they were in Germany. Even so, the establishment flirtation with fascism continued. There were those who were appalled by Mosley and those who looked upon him and would speak with him and socialise with him regularly as being something really very useful to their cause. In the mid-1930s, British fascism took on an increasingly anti-Semitic flavour. Not all fascisms, a case in point being Italian fascism, were necessarily fixated on anti-Semitism. It was quite easy later on for Mussolini to embrace anti-Semitic ideas, but not all were necessarily motivated by anti-Semitic or overtly Nazi racial ideas. But the numbers of Eastern European or second generation Eastern European Jews in the East End of London meant that large numbers of fascists, white British working class fascists, emerged in the same area. And Mosley wanted to take advantage of this in 1936. To march through the East End. Mosley, he planned a big march through the East End and the Communist Party aimed to stop it. Its slogan was, "They shall not pass." The Labour Party advised people to stay away, but this time the Communists were more in tune with the feeling of East Enders, especially the Jewish community, than the Labour leaders. The Communist Party strategy succeeded, and the police told Mosley he could not go ahead with the march. Among the Jews who joined the Communist Party because they saw it as a bulwark against fascism were the later MP, Phil Piriton, who became the first Communist MP in 1945. Sarah Wesker, who was a future Central Committee member, whose experience has partly inspired the first and best plays by her nephew Arnold Wesker 30 years later. And Reuben Fulber, who was to become Assistant General Secretary, and in 1957 took on the task of secretly bringing Soviet money to aid the party. There was a widespread belief, not just amongst communists, not just amongst the left, but amongst the kind of liberal intelligentsia during the 1930s, that only the communists were capable of or inclined to fight the fascists. They were seen as the only effective organisation because of the party discipline that they adhered to. And so later on, the view would be from the kind of the more centre-ground liberal fellow traveller movement through to the left of the Labour Party and also the Communist movement, that only Stalin would be the only effective fighting force to stand up to Hitler, which is why the Nazi Soviet Pact comes as such a huge blow to the democratic left. Communists were appalled, horrified and fearful in July 1936 when the group of Spanish army officers led by General Franco staged a rebellion against the newly elected government, an alliance of Republicans, Socialists and Communists. So coming back to our previous point about popular fronts, Hitler saw the government in Spain as a kind of a creation of Stalin's Russia. Stalin had little time or interest in preserving a centre-ground, left-of-centre government in Spain. And Franco, one of the leaders of the coup, asked Mussolini and Hitler for help. The two responded with ammunition, aircraft and troops. German Condor Legion flew Franco's troops from North Africa to Spain across the Straits of Gibraltar, and without that assistance probably the rebellion would have fizzled out. The Spanish government asked also for help from Western democracies, but Britain and France refused. The British Conservative government pioneered the policy of non-intervention, preventing anyone from selling arms to Spain. The only place from which the Spanish government could get weapons was the Soviet Union. The Communist Party denounced this non-intervention, and sales of the Daily Worker, the British Communist Party's newspaper, soared. Its star reporter, a journalist called Claude Coburn, filed reports from Spain, highly moving and emotive reports. He wrote a very famous book later on in the 1930s called Clifden Set. It was a pamphlet that was published along with the Daily Worker, which essentially said that Waldorf and Nancy Astor, Lord and Lady of Clifden House in Buckinghamshire, were holding parties there, including the editor of the Times, Geoffrey Dawson, and they were preparing Britain's capitulation to Hitler. They were preparing for collaboration, which is to a greater extent true. They were not necessarily Nazis in their own right, certainly highly reactionary right-wing figures, with perhaps fascistic views here and there. But they were really looking for the preservation of the British Empire, and they wanted to make whatever deal they could with Hitler. Though, when the time came, the Clifden Set, when war began, they were fairly dutiful in their service towards Great Britain. But it was a hugely influential piece of writing at the time. So, several communists went to Spain. Several went to work behind the front lines as doctors and ambulance drivers and nurses. A few joined the Republican Army. But Stalin knew that landing Soviet troops in Spain was going to be impossible in terms of logistics, in terms of international pressure, and not wishing to start a wider war. And so instead, Comintern encouraged the formation of the International Brigades, units of anti-fascist volunteers from all countries willing to fight and die alongside the Spanish government forces. Not everyone who went to Spain was a communist. There are plenty who had no time for communism, but also believed that a democratically elected government should not be overthrown by generals. On December the 5th, 1936, Harry Pollitt appealed through the Daily Worker for volunteers to go to Spain and fight. By the end of the month, nearly 500 men had gone, and the next month, the British battalion was formed. The British government at once tried to stop it. The Foreign Office declared that enlisting in the Spanish forces was illegal under the 1870 Foreign Enlistment Act. So recruitment went underground. Groups of recruits assembled and constantly changing venues in London. More than once, frantic search parties were sent out from the Communist Party's Covent Garden headquarters to find, say, a lost group of Scots. In London, the volunteers were given a weekend ticket to Paris. From Paris, they were sent directly to different towns near the Spanish border in the hope of confusing the French authorities. Some were told to get a train to the walled city of Carcassonne, and others went to Perpignan, and others to Sète. They hid for a night or two in the home of a local communist before giving a pair of rope-soled shoes in which to cross the Pyrenees. Every night, groups of men were led across the mountains using smugglers' routes and led by smugglers. They walked for about 16 hours in total darkness, not from freezing cold, through the narrow mountain passes, sometimes deep in snow. "You could only see the man in front," recalled Dave Goodman, one of the volunteers, half a century later. "You relied totally on following him. When someone crashed down into the ravine, I never found out who it was. The wind was often so strong that it almost tore the clothes from their bodies. The men had to hug the ground thousands of feet up on a mountain until it died down." So those were the sorts of challenges that volunteers faced when crossing the Pyrenees over into Spain. When they got to the other side, they were given one final opportunity to turn around and go home. Throughout the journey from the offices of the Covent Garden, the Covent Garden offices of the Communist Party onwards, the volunteers for Spain were consistently told, "This is not a holiday, this is a war. If you're not absolutely certain, please don't go. Please go home now." So they were treated with... there was a great deal of kind of candour about what conditions would be like in Spain. So this story really is one of Stalin attempting to undo the critical error he made in 1932, and by 1936, looking and hoping to Spain for a number of reasons, hoping that possibly a Popular Front government would survive. Though Stalin in many ways didn't care whether the Republic survived and didn't necessarily want an independent social democratic republic in Europe, presenting a different route to socialism. Perhaps the thing that Stalin wanted the most was to give Hitler such a huge quagmire to get stuck in Spain, to commit huge numbers of troops, which would then slow down German militarisation, German rearmament, and give Stalin the opportunity he needed to rearm. Hitler, unfortunately for Stalin, didn't take the bait, and instead of the 150,000 troops that the Italians committed, Hitler kept his to a group of 12,000 soldiers and airmen. But it was a great practice ground for the war that was to come. Anyway, I hope you found that interesting and enjoyable. Do check us out on the Explaining History Facebook group. There's always something new going on there. And also, if you are able to, then check out our Patreon page. We keep going through a little bit of advertising revenue, but the largesse and kindness of our patrons. Take good care. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.